handful of sand contains about 10,000 grains, more than the total number of stars we can see with the naked eye on a clear night. But the number of stars we can see is only the tiniest fraction of the number of stars that are. What we see at night is the merest smattering of the nearest stars, with a few more distant bright stars thrown in for good measure. Meanwhile, the cosmos is rich beyond measure. The total number of stars in the universe is larger than all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the planet Earth.
Cornell's most famous professor is now dead, but Lisa Kaltenegger is carrying on the Sagan tradition, trying to find out what's on those distant planets.
What I do is I'm trying to figure out how we could tell whether or not there could be life on it. Could there be life on the surface of the planet that we can see remotely? And how would it actually appear in our telescopes? Because with hundreds and thousands of planets to pick from, this question whether we are alone in the universe becomes closer and closer to our heart. And trying to tease out what the telltale signs are, that's what I do.
Why is light so crucial?
These stars, these other suns, are very, very far away from us. So if you shrink our solar system to the size of a cookie, then the next star, the next sun over, is 2 football fields away in that scale. So we can't get there. We're trying, but we don't have anything that will get there yet. So light goes through the universe for free, and light hits my telescope. But light has encoded information in it. If it filters through the air of another planet, another world that we found already out there, then it will hit a molecule like water or ozone or oxygen. And so when the light gets to my telescope, there's something missing. The light that hit this molecule on its path. So it's like a stamp in your passport. And so the light can tell me what it encountered, and so it can tell me what the chemical makeup of these planets are.
You've so far got hundreds of planets to choose from. Any signs yet that excite you?
Well, we are basically learning how to do this. This is why these big, hot Jupiter-like planets that we can right now actually explore, because our telescopes are just not big enough to do the small Earth-like planets yet, are exciting. And so with the bigger telescopes coming up, the 40 meter in Chile and the 6.5 James Webb Space Telescope, hopefully launching in 2021, we will for the first time get enough light from these small planets so that we can actually get a glimpse into the atmosphere. And which ones excite me the most? These are the ones that are actually the right distance from their star. It's kind of called the Goldilocks zone, but it's basically just where it's not too hot and not too cold for water to be liquid on the surface. Like when you stand around a bonfire, there's just this right distance where it's nice and warm. Same for the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone. And so those planets, when they're small enough, should be rocks like our own Earth. And those excite me. And currently, we have about 36 of those. But with this new telescope, TESS, that we just launched, where I'm on the science team, what's so exciting, because we're getting more and more planets in, this mission will give us the closest potentially Earth-like planets around all the bright stars you see in the sky. So right now, I'm most excited about those, but I'm not allowed to tell you all about those yet.
Ah, I shall wait. But in the meantime, presumably you are talking to biologists about the kinds of life you might expect, what you're going possibly to look for.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons why I founded the Carl Sagan Institute here at Cornell is to have this interdisciplinary mix of people, because we're creating a forensic toolkit to find life in the universe, in our solar system and outside. And so you need biologists, chemists, astronomers, geophysicists, everybody to help tell you whether this sign is unique for life and how life could represent the color of the planet, the gases in the air. And so we're working together. Currently, we're like 30 faculty from 15 different departments. We even have music in the mix, because there's a person who really likes music and the universe and the galaxies. But it is this brainstorming, pool of interdisciplinary people. And what it just means is that everybody brings a different way of looking at the problem with it. And that's what I think you need to figure out if we're alone in the universe.
Well, that's, of course, what Sagan represented. He wrote about biology. He wrote about the brain. An amazingly learned person. He was educated in Chicago, which specializes in teaching you everything at the highest possible level. But you mentioned music. A certain disc was sent out decades ago, carrying music, and I think, as I remember, Sagan was involved in helping to choose which music went on the disc.
Absolutely, and that must have been terribly difficult. Just think about, you had only one CD and you had to put all of humankind's best music to where it is right now. So the golden record, that was an amazing feast that was undertaken here at Cornell, or started here at Cornell. He reached out to musicians all over the world to basically be able to combine humankind's treasure in terms of music, put it together like a message in a bottle, really, because the probability that it will be found somewhere is really low. But for us to putting it together, to see what humankind has achieved in art, in music, I think that was really the underpinning of just taking a moment and celebrating us as a collective species, and then taking that as the next step and say, and now let's look out and try to find other beings, if you want, like us. But you just mentioned about whether I talk to biologists. Well, one of the next papers that comes out, that's still under embargo right now, is actually, we looked around and some of these small stars that we're finding planets around, even our next star, Proxima Centauri, is actually a red star with a lot of UV radiation hitting the planet. And so there's a real fear that that would actually keep life from evolving in the first place. So we looked around on the Earth with biologists and we said, what does life on the Earth actually do? And so there you can go underwater, you can burrow on the soil so that you get sheltered from UV radiation. Or, especially as you're in Australia, there are these beautiful corals. If you actually hit them with UV light, they biofluorescence. They start to actually shine these beautiful colors. And they do that because they live in symbiosis with an algae that cannot deal with UV radiation. So on our Earth, we never had a huge UV environment, a little bit bigger, but not that bad. But it developed even here on Earth. So if you now say that life would develop somewhere else, and maybe it would take a similar pathway, then when this UV light hits another planet, maybe that UV light, being broken down into harmless visible radiation, will actually make the planet shine in brilliant colors, and that would allow us to maybe even find hidden biospheres that might just have developed, like the corals you might see on your next diving trip.
And you're developing that sort of technology that can spot those different lights here at your institute?
Absolutely. But we also have a spectrograph where we actually look at different kind of life and how it would present. And so we're taking that into the mix of modeling how another world could be dominated. I don't know, think about a red algae planet or a green algae planet, or think about a frozen planet with bacteria that can live on ice, or a desert world with kind of weird things that you might not even be able to think about. But we want to be ready because these telescopes are being built right now, and we have to tell them how long they have to look to not miss signs of life.
By the way, I don't think you met Sagan himself, did you?
No, I never met Sagan, unfortunately. I would love to have a dinner date and just talk to him about all the exciting things that have happened ever since he anticipated that this would actually be the way. And unfortunately, he never saw it come to fruition. But everybody in the Carl Sagan Institute has a story about how Carl Sagan inspired them through a book, through one of his lectures, how he's one of the reasons why they became scientists.
Of course, there's a series called Cosmos, which he presented way back and which has been redone recently with another presenter.
Absolutely. So Anne Druyan, his wife and widow, is actually the amazing creative mind behind Cosmos right now. She was part of the original team, and she was also part of the Golden Record team that actually collected which images we would send on this message in a bottle on Voyager 1 to the next stars. And so she has taken this vision that they both shared, and now with new technology and CGI, it's amazing what you can bring to life. And unfortunately, it's not Carl Sagan anymore who can lead us through these amazing discoveries, but I think her vision and his overlapped quite a bit. So when you see the new Cosmos, to me, I see a lot of the old Cosmos in it. And I miss Sagan because, of course, that's what I know from the Cosmos series, but I think they're doing a great job trying to bring it to the next generation that might just not have seen the last one.
Lisa Kaltenegger is director of the Carl Sagan Institute and professor of astronomy at Cornell. The inspiration continues. The Science Show on RN.